Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. On Fast Forward Radio and at The Speculist, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
We're, making up for the fact that we didn't have a show last week by doing a somewhat longer show.
Yeah, well, we had had a show on Sunday night, or was it Saturday night?
Saturday
night,
yeah.
Yeah, that's right, Saturday night.
Well, early Sunday morning for some.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah. It all evened out, and, check the archives, it's all there.
It's all there. We haven't missed a week in quite some time.
The audience. It was a great show, but yeah, we got it. Since we weren't here last Wednesday, yeah, we're giving you a little lanyard tonight, audience. So
that's right.
Pretty awesome.
Because we care.
Yeah, exactly. And because we care, we ought to send a shout out to Sean Connery, 80 years old today.
80 years old, Sean Connery. So let's tie Sean Connery into the whole world of The Speculist and Fast Forward Radio.
Let's see. How would we do that? Let's think
I
of his movies
it.
For just.
Oh
yeah.
Wait,
PJ, jump in. We got some guests tonight, and PJ, jump in.
How would we tie
in Sean Connery to?
No, this is Christine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Better.
That's okay. Here's how Sean Connery fits. Sean Connery is undoubtedly still hot at his age. There's no question. Obviously, this man is doing great life extension technology, and we'll
yeah, exactly. He is.
Night.
He is 80 years old, and he's sexy. He's not immortal yet, Phil, but
working. He's the prototype. This man is a budding sexy immortal billionaire with superpowers, right?
Yeah,
there.
Not quite a billionaire, I wouldn't imagine, but he's
well. I said budding.
Yeah, he's on his way though, right?
Exactly. So. There you go. He's hot. He's 80. There it is. That's where we're all going. We're all going to be hot at 80. That's a beautiful thing. Of course, he was hot, when he was. 25. So that's why it's even more, spectacular when we make it to 80, like super sexy. Well, the voice you just heard was that of Christine Peterson. Christine writes, lectures, and briefs the media on coming powerful technologies, especially nanotechnology. She's the co-founder and president of the Foresight Institute, the leading nanotech public interest group. Foresight educates the public, the technical community, and policymakers on nanotechnology and its long-term effects. And she's here tonight to talk with us a little bit about an upcoming conference on personalized life extension. So, Christine, thanks for connecting the dots there on Sean Connery, and welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Oh, it's always great to be here.
Excellent. We also have with us tonight PJ Manny. She's a writer and futurist and a leading voice in the Humanity Plus movement. She is an occasional guest host on Fast Forward Radio, as well as being our official Hollywood correspondent. Welcome, PJ.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's great to be back.
Always a pleasure to have you here, PJ. And we've also got with us, returning to complete our discussion on the Singularity Summit, is Canadian futurist, consultant, and award-winning blogger George Dvorsky, who writes and speaks extensively about the impacts of cutting-edge science and technology, particularly as they pertain to the improvement of human performance and experience. George, always great to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Okay, well, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking a little bit about the Singularity Summit, but before we do that, we want to start off by talking about this upcoming event, Personalized Life Extension, and just to kind of lay out what we're doing on the program tonight to to wrap it back in, tie it back in with last time. I was doing short audio interviews with attendees and speakers at the conference, and we played, how many of those last time, Stephen? Three, I think?
Yeah, that's right.
We did three last time, and actually we have three this time because I have two pre-recorded, and the third one I recorded was with Christine Peterson talking about her upcoming event, and I accidentally erased that recording, so she was good enough to come on and talk live about that. So we decided to extend the show a little bit and give that topic as much time as it deserves, because it's a very exciting event that's coming up. I believe it will be in October, if I'm not mistaken. And tell us a little bit, of, just logistically, Christine, when and where it's going to be.
The conference will be October 9th and 10th at the San Francisco Airport Marriott here in the Bay Area. So I hope to see as many of your listeners there as possible.
Well, you know, it's handy having it at the airport hotel. That's a great idea, actually. People can fly right in. They can attend the conference and zip right back out again. Now, let's talk a little bit about the meaning of personalized life extension. What is personalized life extension, and how would what is going to occur at this conference, how would that differ from what you might see or hear at another life extension conference?
Well, the reason that I wanted to start this conference series is that, you know, first of all, many of us are into anti-aging. We all want to delay aging, especially our own personal aging. And there are some wonderful conferences out there that look at the research on anti-aging. They're great. However, these are generally focused on the long term. In other words, this is basic research. It won't be getting products out to us that we can actually use for a very long time, probably. So the question becomes, what can we do now to delay aging so that we're still around when these more exotic advanced techniques come through and become available? And I, as someone who's been into this topic since the 70s, looked around and I could not find a conference that filled the bill on this, where I could go and find out what can I personally do and what can my friends do. So I said, well, gosh, let's just do it. And that's what this is about. Now, why is personalized in the name? It turns out that it's just not the case, for example, that everyone should do the same thing for life extension, especially on the more tricky things like supplements, which is a big issue. So you really need to do some testing, and you need to track things, and that's what's personalized. This is kind of a spin-out of the whole quantified self phenomenon, which some of your listeners may know about.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, the quantified self phenomenon? That sounds interesting.
So quantified self is kind of a movement that started here in the San Francisco Bay Area maybe a year or two ago, something like that. And it was started by Kevin Kelly, well known to folks who might read Wired magazine, and many other interesting things that Kevin has done over the years. So Kevin got interested in this whole idea of measuring things about your life. Now, the main one that people seem to focus on is things about your body, but it can also be things about your time management, your energy usage, you name it. Obviously, I'm focusing on the health aspect of quantified self. And the quantified self phenomenon started here, but it spread across the United States, and now it's hopped overseas as well. So all around the world, people are starting to say, gosh, especially technical people say, you know, I need to turn my technical skills for a little while away from my computer or whatever is my technical specialty and focus on my body. You know, my body needs some technical attention here. So that's what the quantified self effort helps us do.
See, this is really interesting. This goes to a conversation that we were having right before the show started. The comment was made that we only have one real life extension authority on the program tonight, and actually, when you look at it from the standpoint of the quantified self, and when you look at it from the standpoint of different individuals are going to need different approaches, then in a sense we're all authorities, or at least our bodies are all authorities on what it is that's going to work for us. We kind of become what's the word I'm looking for? It's like we've got all the data, right? That you need to start looking at in order to start making improvements and maybe customizing or individualizing a course of treatment for aging.
That's exactly right. We each have to become, if we aren't already, we each have to become the authority on our own body, because no one else is going to care quite as much as you do about your personal aging. It really is up to you to step up to that, and the goal of the conference and of the whole quantified self effort is to help you do that, to help you figure out what needs to be measured, you know, what these numbers mean, where you want to be with the numbers, how do you move those numbers into the optimal range. So, yes, it's all about taking personal control.
And then to take that idea of who's an authority on life extension one step further, I'm really interested in the lineup of speakers that you have there, because I see some names like Gregory Benford, who is, you know, connected with Genescient, or Terry Grossman, who authors books on life extension with Ray Kurzweil. And those are people that I would typically think of as, oh, okay, there's your life extension experts. But then I'm also seeing names like Esther Dyson, Peter Thiel, Sonia Arison. How are these folks fitting in? What are they bringing to the table around personalized life extension?
Well, I'm dividing the participants at this conference into three groups. The first group are the expert life extension professionals. These are people like Terry Grossman and Greg Fay and Shelley Hendler. These folks are well known in the field. They're very respected. They have a lot to bring to us in terms of advice and expertise, and that's fantastic. So we need those folks. But also I really wanted to bring in the early adopters, the implementers. These are folks who are ahead of the curve in terms of doing these quantified self-style measurements and taking action, using the new products that are out there to help them alter their bodies into being in a more beneficial state. So those are the folks, those are some of the names you may not recognize. People like Matt Bell, Ramesh Rao, Larry Smar, these guys, they're extremely bright guys, generally very technical, and obviously some women too. Guys means men and women, of course. And these are people who, generally technical, but they've turned their attention away from their usual specialty, which is often computing, toward their own bodies. And so these are folks who, because they're not full-time in the biological or medical sciences, can speak more directly to us about what is it really like when you step up to this and how do you really go about it as basically a layperson, because most of us, we're not physicians, we're not biologists. How do we do these things? So those are the early adopters. And then we have the folks in the audience who I think a lot of them, you know, some will be brand new to this, but a lot of them have already begun to try to take action. In terms of Esther Dyson and Peter Thiel, who are our keynotes, these are inspirational folks. They have stepped up with their own personal funds to try to move this field forward in terms of entrepreneurial startups, and also have, they're also early adopters in terms of using the techniques and the equipment that's available. So everybody on the list has something special to bring to this party, and I just can't wait. I think it's going to be a total blast.
It sounds so exciting, and I'm looking over this list of strategies for extending life, and it'll take just a moment. I'm just going to read this list out, and then maybe we can open it up amongst our panel here and talk about this a little bit. But here are the strategies that are listed: supplements, DNA testing, telomere protection, blood testing, finding a life extension doctor, gadgets, inflammation, calorie restriction and intermittent fasting, sleep, stress reduction, self-experimentation, exercise, enhancement and brain function, eating, standards of information quality, and mood. So all these factors potentially playing into life extension on a personalized level. I think let's go around the group, and this idea just occurred to me. I think we're probably all doing one or two of these things. So I'd like to see how we're doing as a panel in terms of what things we're working on strategy wise for life extension, and maybe Christine, as these topics occur, you can tell us what, if anything, will be done with them on the at the conference. I'm real interested in the one about sleep because I know I don't get enough sleep, and I was reading Michael Anisimov's blog the other day, and he was talking about he was promoting your conference, and he talked about the things he does. He started listing his things, and he says he diets and he exercises and he gets 9 hours of sleep a night. And I thought, wow, this young guy gets 9 hours of sleep a night. I need to take a page from his book because I don't do nearly that well with sleep. And I got to think, what of the stuff he mentioned? I take some supplements. I have made a real effort to get what I take to be inflammatory foods out of my diet, and I exercise. So those are kind of the big three that I do. How about you, Stephen?
Well, carbohydrate restriction and exercise. And when I say exercise, I mean I exercise with resistance training. Basically free weights. I found that I can keep weight off better with carbohydrate restriction and combined with free weights than I can even with caloric restriction and the treadmill. It's I've seen some remarkable progress with using the combination of those two things.
Well, anybody who's looked at your photos on Facebook, it's really you've had some real you've made some real progress, and congratulations on that.
Well, you know, part of it is the quantified self. I wasn't calling it that because I had not heard the term. But something that people that are overweight tend not to do, they never go near the scale, right?
Mm, yeah.
And they just don't want to know how bad, what kind of deficit, a health deficit they're running. It's a hard thing to face. But once you start facing it and start saying, okay, I'm making some progress here, you know, and you're on that scale all the time, and I think that it just really helps. That's just one, you know, and of course that's just one thing to one factor to quantify, but I think it's an important one.
All right, well, there's a couple more. How about you, PJ? Anything on that list ring a bell for you?
Pretty much all of them.
Oh, wow. What are you doing to protect your telomeres? I want to hear about this.
Well, okay, maybe not exactly telomere protection, but I've been doing supplementation for years.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered that it made an enormous change in my health starting about 25 years ago. And as more information's come and I've been able to fine-tune what works and what doesn't work, along with blood testing and working with a doctor, that's been an enormous help for me. I've done DNA testing. Not that I didn't feel that 23andMe gave me any information I really didn't know if I looked at my parents, to be honest. I've tried gadgets. I try to eat anti-inflammation foods and what they call superfoods. My sleep is much better than it used to be. I do a little meditation. One thing I really wish I would do more of is exercise, and I need to get weights back into my training program. And I'd like to eat less, just in general, lower my calorie count. But, you know, a lot of it, I've done some of it at pretty much some point in my life. I've done almost everything.
Wow.
And it's,
so that would be the self-experimentation list.
I'm a big believer in self-experimentation because I very much feel everybody is different. There are definite similarities to everyone by virtue of being human. And then when you parse it down, though, to the fine information, you start to realize how different you can be. For instance, what Stephen was saying about diet, I'm very much like him. I need fewer carbohydrates. And that reflects my genetic makeup. And, again, all I have to do is look at my parents and see their own health issues and recognize that. Whereas for other people, that kind of a diet might not be the best thing for them. Until we have better genetic information, however, I think it'll be very difficult. I think it's going to be a little more catch-as-catch-can. We just don't have the data yet to know for sure what works for you.
And I guess that's where the self-experimentation and the process of people beginning to quantify themselves really makes a difference. It takes me back to this idea, George, that we were talking about a few weeks ago when we were talking about the H Plus Summit. This idea of the citizen scientist. Here we are, citizen scientists doing original research on ourselves. Right, we're observing ourselves and learning about ourselves, and hopefully that all adds up to something like empirical and predictable and reproducible. How about you, George? Any of those items?
I do three things in particular I want to focus on, three very simple things, but how I go about them is probably not so simple. I tend to kind of go full on, hardcore on things. So exercise, diet, and constant mental stimulation. So I can discuss the different things that I do. So I'll start with diet. Very, very strict eater. I eat very, very cleanly, as they say. And what I try to do is I strive for what's been recently dubbed the Paleolithic diet. What it is the a diet that approximates as closely as possible the dietary habits of our Stone Age or Paleolithic ancestors. And the idea there is that, you know what, we have the same bodies that those folks had 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 years ago, if not even more. And a lot of the foods that we're eating today, mainly the and almost exclusively the processed foods, our bodies doesn't know what the hell to do with it, and it's really messing us up. And it is the cause of a lot of ailments. I think what we consider to be diseases of our time, everything from diabetes to obesity and even cancer rates and all these sorts of things. I'm highly suspicious that when all is said and done, we'll be pointing to the kinds of eating habits that that we are engaged in today. So when I say as a paleo, I mean, I'm not 100% there. I have my cheat days, and there are things that I kind of still do that our Stone Age ancestor did not eat. But things that I've eliminated completely from my diet are things like bread. Mm-hmm. I don't eat rice. These kind of high-density carbohydrates I've completely eliminated. I don't eat pasta at all. But basically, I will eat things that, you know, if you can kind of if you can pick it and find it, I'll eat it. Lots of nuts, lots of berries, tons of berries, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries. I definitely get my antioxidant levels in control through that sort of a thing. And that's pretty much what I do from a dietary perspective. And then from an exercise point of view, I do what's called CrossFit, which is kind of a growing fitness movement right now. It's kind of an elite fitness program, or at least a very specialized fitness program that is quite involved, and it's what's referred to as functional fitness. And it's, again, this kind of shift away from traditional gyms where, you know, particularly guys will know this, you know, you go to the gym and you do your sit-ups, you go on the treadmill for a few minutes, go to the back, and, you know, today is going to be my biceps day, tomorrow is going to be my legs day. In other words, kind of micro-focusing, and really what it is, it's kind of an outgrowth of bodybuilding culture, and we kind of fell away from, and we kind of knew this about 80 years or so ago when fitness movements still first emerged in North America and Europe, is you got to move your body, and you got to move your body in a natural way, and almost in a way that kids do when you watch kids play. So the things that we do on a regular basis at CrossFit are a lot of body weight exercises. We do tons of squats and sit-ups and push-ups, and we skip rope. We do gymnastics, so we do things like pull-ups like crazy. We do rings, things that require balance and coordination, agility, and we do Olympic weightlifting. We lift heavy crap, very heavy stuff, and it's all done at very high intensity. So the workouts can be as short as 5 minutes, but it's going to be the hardest 5 minutes you ever worked in your life, or it could be long as 45 minutes. That's another thing, is every time you're doing it, it's extremely different. It's highly, highly varied workouts. So you're not doing the same thing twice. Every workout you go to is pretty much different. So you're always kind of engaging different parts of your body and your mind. So that's what I do there. And in terms of kind of like the mental aspect of things, I'm constantly keeping myself mentally stimulated. And that can still involve things like physical activity. So, for example, I'm taking a mixed martial arts class right now, learning the basics of how to fight and protect yourself. I've also taken up painting, so I'm learning how to paint for the first time in my life. So I'm kind of exploring new kind of new spaces there, both creatively wise and artistically, and you know, cognitively. So I'm trying to do that as well. And of course, just through the you know, coming on radio like this and speaking to all, keeping myself stimulated, and again keeping those the neurons in my brain sparking away as much as possible. So that's kind of my long-winded answer, but I do take this subject extremely seriously, quite obviously. And I basically try to look, what is around me right now that I can do that's going to have impact. And to what you were speaking about, the citizen scientist aspect and kind of experimenting on ourselves and actually having empirical results. I mean, I can tell you right now, absolutely, I know that I feel fantastic. And for example, if the diet is working, if you've dialed it in properly, when you go to the gym and your performance is reflective of that. And it's,
right.
It's very common amongst CrossFitters to keep track of your performance. It's almost kind of a mandatory thing. You've got to either you do it on a paper notebook log or do a blog, whatever. But you want to chart your progress and see how you're doing, and you can kind of correlate that against your eating habits or changes to your eating habits. So it's very much a scientific experiment, which is pretty interesting if you think about it. So
yeah
that's
that
what
is,
I do.
That is interesting stuff, and I love the idea of opening your mind up to new ideas, to trying new things. It seems like that is a before there was even a concept of life extension, I think it was understood that you can at least add life to your years, if not years to your life, by just trying new things out, by keeping your mind open and learning as you continue to age. It makes life richer, even if it doesn't make it longer. But I have a feeling that it might also make it longer as well. Well, here's the thread. This is interesting that I'm hearing across the four of us, and then we'll have Christine kind of weigh in on how we're doing. It sounds like, interestingly, we're all on low-carb diets of one variety or another, so that happened accidentally. And everyone seems to be more skewed towards resistance training than cardio. Is that right? Or, PJ, do I misinterpret what you said?
Right now I'm doing more cardio than resistance, but I'd like to do more resistance.
Oh, okay. Because you know who we need on this panel is Alex Lightman, right? He would chime in for cardio in a huge way, but he's not with us. So, because Stephen, you're lifting weights. I do actually body weight resistance. George, it sounds like you're doing a combo of body weight serious heavy weightlifting stuff.
Yeah, cardio is definitely a big part of it. CrossFit particular, they've done is they've segmented it down to what they call 10 fitness domains. And again, I don't want to necessarily waste a lot of time talking about this, but they have segmented 10 fitness domains that you want to work on, and cardio is definitely one out of 10. And they don't value any one more than any other. So stamina is also there, and so is endurance, which are kind of very much related to the whole cardio thing. So I think focusing on cardio, let's say specifically, you're getting one out of 10 different types of fitness domains that you should be working on.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it's there. So I shouldn't say that it wasn't included in your list of things. And let's see what else. I didn't hear. Well, PJ talked to, I think, about meditation. So the idea of reducing stress. One of the things that this reminds me of is when Terry Grossman was on the show about a year ago. He laid all this info on us. It was a great discussion. We got to the end of the 45 minutes. We had 45 minutes with Aubrey de Grey and 45 minutes with Terry Grossman, and we got to the end of his half of the show, and I said, for people listening, if there were three things, if there's three things you could do, what would they be? And he said, don't eat sugar, cut stress, and exercise. Those were the three things, and it sounds like we're kind of moving in and around those. Christine,
just wanted to quickly just say sugar is poison. I completely agree with that sentiment and the others that he noted there.
Yeah, the three, I mean, they sound like very basic things, but how are we doing as a group, do you think, Christine? Would we have anything to contribute to the event, and are we on the right track?
Well, I definitely think that everything people have said here is on the right track, and of course that's not surprising given the future orientation of this group, that they have already, they're way ahead of the curve in terms of being early adopters on some of these health strategies. So I would think, anyone on the call here that we've heard from would definitely have things to add. And I certainly would encourage them to attend. I think all of us also have something to learn, because the fact the human body is an incredibly, and I think we all know this, an incredibly mind-bogglingly complex thing that we're trying to influence here, and it's extremely difficult. So we do need to compare notes, as we just were doing, and I think that's where the power was going to come from this conference, is getting us all to compare notes directly, and that's the goal. So we just got started. I think we heard some great stuff that I definitely agree with. I agree on cutting carbs. I agree on the resistance. I do all of these on the list. The only one I haven't gotten to yet is the DNA testing, and I'm going to see if I can set up a show special for the conference where we can get a discount on our DNA testing, because it does still cost. If you don't get a discount, it does still cost somewhere around $500, so we need to get that down. But,
now, let's talk about that one, actually. When you get the DNA testing done, what happens then? How does that help you extend your life?
Well, it's interesting. I went to people are a little touchy about publicizing their personal DNA information, and that's totally understandable. But I was invited to a private meeting of about 10 people who all had their DNA tested, all by 23andMe, and were trying to struggle with interpreting it because it's a huge amount of data. And the 23andMe website has a great deal of material to kind of wade through to try to figure out what's going on. So it was explained in some detail, okay, here are the different things they're measuring, here's what you should look at, here's how to use the darn website and find out, okay, here's what you need to do. And I think if people do change their behavior patterns, if they do learn something new, which I think often people do, it sounds like in PJ's case perhaps she didn't really learn anything new, but I think people often do learn something new, and it does influence their behavior. And basically just make them more health conscious and focus more on dealing with whatever health issues their genes tell them are going to be more of a problem for them.
So before we leave this, I want to get into a couple of these because I threw the word out there, and I think it would be interesting to know a little bit more. When we say gadgets, what are we talking about?
Well, especially if you think of the quantified self model, you need to do measurements. We need to measure all kinds of things about your body. And of course, you know, here in Silicon Valley, we love our gadgets. And it also makes it easier and kind of more fun, actually, when you can get actual readings and manipulate those numbers. That's kind of fun and cool. So if the gadgets work, we want to use them. And there's some wonderful fun things out there. For example, we're going to be hearing about the Zio Sleep Monitor, which you wear while you're sleeping, and you get incredibly detailed information about your sleep. And sleep is really important, and of course it's kind of hard to know what's going on because we're sleeping. So you need those numbers. And then there's just kind of lower tech gadgets, like I've listed here on the homepage, the shoulder flex massager. And the reason I listed it is I have one, and you know I don't have anybody to give me a massage every night, and it's asking actually a lot to have somebody give you a really long massage every night. So I have this device, and I love it. So there's just all these cool things you can use to get healthier, and it's just fun to compare notes, and they can save us a lot of time and money, I think.
Very cool. Well, one other question. Of all the items on the list that I read out, how many of these are, per PJ's point earlier, how many of these would you say we have a well-established link to life extension for modifying these, and how many of these we suspect a link, and we're moving ahead with gathering more data? Because the reason I ask is I know that, for example, that there are health benefits associated with exercise. It just it's well established, and from a very conventional, not having a heart attack and dying standpoint, exercise is proven as it's a good thing to do. It's a good healthy thing to do. But is there evidence showing, is there actual clinical evidence showing what the life extension benefit of different kinds of exercise are? Or eating is another good example. We were talking about like a lower carbohydrate diet, cutting sugar out of your diet. These are things that definitely help to restrict, cut your weight, and there's clearly health benefits associated with that. But there's also ideas like I was talking about caloric restriction and intermittent fasting. Is there real hard evidence to link that to life extension? And I'm not asking, I guess, about those specific things, but just generally, how many of these are strategies that have real empirical data behind them, and how many are still in a more of a we're figuring it out as we go kind of a stage?
Well, that's a great question, and you'll see on that list, if you look at the page, the homepage, lifeextensionconference.com, the list at the top, one of the items is standards of information quality. Mm. In other words, all of us are inundated with health information. There's this huge stream of data and claims, health claims, coming at us every day. And so the question is, how do you evaluate these? Some of them, you can get good data. There's large double-blind studies that have been done, and you could say, wow, look at this. This is clearly a good thing or clearly a bad thing. And it's very easy to make a judgment call. But in most of these on the list, there haven't been very large, multiple very large double-blind studies. And there may never be, because in some cases these techniques and these supplements that we're considering taking are not patentable. And so it's not clear, unless a government or foundation funds it, it's not clear who's going to fund these very extensive studies. So often we are forced to make our decisions based on partial data, data that is not what we would ideally like to have, or even in some cases anecdotal data, which is very distressing. But on the other hand, every day we're making decisions, and we have to use the data that's available. So there's definitely some things on this list that are more edgy, and we're going to be trying to address that at the conference and make it very clear to the audience, number one, this is either very firmly established or it's edgy. Here's, the data that we have, and make your own judgment call. And number two, here's how to think about all the health claims you hear outside the conference, which, we're all going to leave the conference, and then we're continually still going to be bombarded with new information. So how do you judge that information? So that's one of the goals of the meeting, is to get people to feel a little more confident in how they're going to judge all these health claims that come at them.
So it really sounds like a terrific opportunity to get more information on each of these, and also to maybe just start putting this whole tsunami of information we got on this subject into some kind of context.
That's exactly the goal, and also to have fun. It turns out having fun is good for life extension.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Now, I see in the chat room, Sally has raised the issue about sleep, so I thought I would just throw this out to the panel. She points out that as you age, she says, definitely lose more and more quality sleep. You end up doing a lot of tossing and turning, and it gets harder and harder to get the good night's sleep. First off, Christine, could you tell us what is the stated or theorized link between sleep and life extension, and how are there guidelines on how much sleep we should be getting?
What I've seen, and I'm not a sleep expert, but what I have seen is just statistically, if they look at lifespan, people live the longest if they get between 7 to 9 hours of sleep. I've also heard it claimed, and this is, I'm not sure about this, but it's an interesting claim, that men require about an hour more sleep than women do per night. I don't know if this is true, but it's something we should look into. So I think it's clear that getting good quality sleep will help, for example, lower your cortisol levels. And cortisol is one of the stress hormones, and many of us are too high. We need to get that down, and one of the reasons it's high is that we are not sleeping enough, we're not sleeping deeply enough, and our bedrooms are not dark enough. So sleep is a very important thing, and just to agree, melatonin can be helpful, but I think there are other things as well that we probably need to do.
Okay. Well, we're gonna keep tracking that one. I actually have to echo Sally's issues around sleep. It seems as I get older, I sleep less, and I have a lot more trouble sleeping than I used to. And when I hear somebody like Michael say he's getting 9 hours of sleep a night, I'm like, man, how does he find the time to sleep 9 hours a night?
Well, you know, that's not too hard to figure out. You have a small child.
That really does
do things to your sleep patterns, and you know, and expectantly so, because you now have to respond in the middle of the night to this child. I will tell you that after having children myself, it took me years to get my sleep back to what would be considered a normal, healthy amount, 7 to 9 hours, et cetera. But for me, I took the non-pharmaceutical route eventually, because I tried everything. And what really worked for me was the very non-glamorous sleep mask, eye cover.
Like in the old movies, yeah.
Like in the old movies, mine are not, you know, pink satin. I think I got them off of an airplane to Australia 1 year. And a pair of earplugs, because absolutely the amount of light that you can perceive through your closed eyelids affects your sleep profoundly, which is why shift workers have difficulty sleeping during the day. You actually have to sleep in a blacked out room, and if you can't black out your room, you can black out your eyes.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting. And you know, it's interesting you mentioned the young child too, because the irony of it is, I think that's true. That was very disruptive to whatever progress I had made in that regard up to this point in my life. But now here we are. She's 16 months old. I put her to bed, about half an hour before the show started, and she's good for 11 hours now. So.
You are the luckiest man alive.
But I mean, she's getting the sleep, so that you know, as long as somebody's getting it. Okay, before we leave this topic, George, any parting thoughts on life extension? Questions for Christine, or additional just ideas that
you guys,
that
I think
that
you guys
like
covered everything. I mean, I'm actually just taking notes here as you guys are flying through all this, particularly the sleep aspect. That's definitely an area that I want to now inquire into a bit more. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, I'd like to throw out a couple more topics that could be discussed at the conference. I think socialization, and it's something we've kind of touched on sort of tangential, in passing, but I think socialization is huge. You know, people that live alone just don't tend to live as long as someone who is particularly in a healthy relationship, and the more friends you have, the longer you tend to live. I think it's and maybe the firing of those neurons, right, George? But I think there's something to it. The more socialized we are.
Well, and I think Christine, you touched on that. Oh, I'm sorry, George. Go ahead.
I just want to say that you guys and I have seen the same studies about the correlating between partners and life extension.
Yep.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, Christine, you touched on that when you mentioned that we live longer if we have fun.
Yep.
Yes, and I think if you look on the conference has put that topic under mood and mentions the role of love and intimacy, married people and those in monogamous long-term relationships are said to live longer. So it's an interesting question. Why is this? How can we, how can we have those great high-quality partners, high-quality friendships? And I think they do make a huge difference in our longevity.
And mental health is the other thing I was going to throw out, which is all tied together with this too, isn't it? So,
I think George touched on that earlier too. I think one of the ways we help preserve our mental health is probably to continue to try to expand our thinking, to keep opening up new avenues of where we're going with our thought life. Anything else there, Stephen? Good
That's
stuff.
It. That's it.
Good stuff. PJ, parting thoughts on the subject of life extension?
I really, really hope we learn as much as we can so we all live long, healthy, and happy lives.
I'm shocked you didn't say empathy.
You know, I can't bang the same drum all the time, Stephen.
It's a good drum. There's nothing wrong with that drum.
That is a good drum, and no doubt important for life extension as well. So we're hoping that there will be a great turnout for this event. Once again, those of you who saw it linked at the Speculus, and we'll be linking it again here in our show notes. If you register and use the discount code Speculist, you get, what was it again, Christine, $100 off the registration.
$100 off. Yeah, gets
and
it down to $175. Yeah.
That's what a deal. And listeners of this program, you can also use the discount code Fast Forward. Was it Fast Forward or Fast Forward Radio?
Fast Forward Radio.
Fast Forward Radio. So just type that in when you register, and once again, you get $100 off. So looking for someone to cover the event for Fast Forward Radio and the Speculist. Stephen and I are not going to be able to attend, so one of you who wants to be part of the podcast in a few weeks and report back to us, get registered and let us know how it went. Really looking forward to it. Once again, it is, I believe, lifeextensionconference.com, and the event will be October 9th and 10th at the Airport Marriott in San Francisco. So looking forward to that. Okay. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're going to shift gears a little bit now, and we're going to continue our wrap-up of the Singularity Summit. I was fortunate enough to attend that week before last, and we had done a quick run-through on some of the sessions I had attended, but more to the point, George and Stephen and I were talking about all the important conversations you have between the sessions. That's what really seems to make these kinds of events very meaningful, and that's kind of what we're doing on the program here tonight. We're having additional conversations related to the topics of the Singularity Summit. So if you're looking for a complete line-by-line breakdown of what happened, just scroll back in the Speculist a little bit, or scroll down, I should say, and I did my best to transcribe what was occurring there, but we're not going to try to replay everything that occurred. We're just going to bring up a few points of interest and talk about those. Now, one of the folks I got to meet who I had not met before and who I was really interested in what he had to say was Ramez Nam, and he was good enough to spend a few moments talking with me. And Stephen, if we've got that interview, why don't we just go ahead and give that a listen?
I'm talking with Ramez Nam, who is the author of More Than Human. He spoke with us today at the Singularity Summit on the subject of the digital biome. Ramez, I was fascinated by the optimistic outlook that you provided in your talk. Earlier in the day, Eliezer Yudkowsky had given us a breakdown of worldviews wherein one was either a technophile, a technophobe, a techno-normal, or a techno-volatile, and suggested that most serious thinkers fall into the techno-volatile category. You disclaimed that category. Why are you not a techno-volatile, and how would you describe yourself?
Well, I think that people can easily fall into the trap of either thinking everything is doom or everything is great, and they're both cognitive distortions. The reality is that the world is immensely more prosperous today than it was 100 years ago, but there's still poverty and starvation. So things can get tremendously better and have problems. Even in the Dark Ages, when the world got generally worse, there were a lot of innovations in social areas and organization. The fuel system had some advantages over Rome. So it's seldom the case that things are just going in one direction. That said, I am an optimist. I do think the world is getting better. I think we face the largest global scale threats we've ever faced. But if we take the right steps, I think they're very surmountable, and that we can keep raising human welfare for decades at least, or maybe centuries to come.
In your talk, you outlined a number of these basically almost existential threats to our civilization around food supply, fresh water, energy, and outlined solutions to each of those problems, which I thought was great. Rarely do you hear a laundry list of problems like that and then get a good solution to each one. If you were to categorize just what the overarching solution is, what these solutions have in common, what is the trend that that can get us out of these various messes?
Well, what I was highlighting was that nature is already incredibly powerful, incredibly versatile, and incredibly fluid and efficient in making use of resources. And we are actually bathed in abundant resources. The sun delivers as much energy every hour as all of human civilization uses in a year. So we do have these incredibly large-scale and very challenging threats of climate change, peak oil, freshwater depletion, et cetera, et cetera. But we can learn from biology of the entire planet and we can potentially improve on it. We can remix it, if you will. We can take advantage of genes that exist in one part of nature and transplant them to another to get better results and help surmount these problems.
I noticed in the discussion of global warming, you got some pushback from some of the questioners, some of the attendees on the likelihood of the veracity of the evidence for that. You made an interesting comment about levels of risk and the precautions that we take during your talk. The analogy was, I think, the probability that you might get hit by a car, that you might have a heart attack. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The analogy I made was just that. We don't know if global warming is going to cause massive problems. We know that it's going to cause some problems. We don't know if it's really going to end civilization if left unchecked. But there's a chance that it could. In the past, we have had periods on this planet of extremely rapid, abrupt climate change, where in the span of a decade or two, temperatures changed by 10 degrees or more. And that is the sort of thing that can get to be cataclysmic. That is the sort of thing that can really impact human welfare and potentially make resources more scarce, put nations at war with each other, fighting over scarce resources. Even if the chance of that is only 1%, we owe it to ourselves to take out an insurance policy against that. And by investing in the right new innovations, by investing in conservation and efficiency, and so on. If we had 1,000 planets to humanity, and just one of them was going through global warming, we might say, we don't really know if it's serious, just let it go. But right now, all of our eggs are in one basket. All of the intelligence that we know of in the entire universe exists on this planet. Hopefully there's more out there, but I think that's too precious for us to take that big a risk with, and especially if the cost of mitigation is actually rather small. Let's go ahead and invest in the R&D, let's go ahead and invest in making it more expensive to pollute, and we'll get the right results.
Your book is called More Than Human. Can you give us a brief synopsis of what that's about?
That's my 2005 book, and that is on using biotech to make people superhumans and cyborgs, making us stronger, smarter, faster, longer-lived, interfacing with computers. And it's a book of science and of ethics, and I basically, in addition to explaining why this is possible and coming in the next few decades, I go into the case that it will make the world better off, that it will elevate people both rich and poor over the long run, and that it's very natural and human to seek enhancement of our abilities. Any of us who have smartphones know that today.
Absolutely. And you said you're working on a new book. Can you tell us a little about that?
I'm working on two new books. I'm working on a science fiction novel, and I'm working on another nonfiction book about boosting collective intelligence to address a number of these problems, like global warming, peak oil, and so on, making the case that innovation and intelligence is actually the most powerful force on this planet, that economics are a non-zero sum because of our ability to invent and share new ideas, and that if we harness those forces properly, we can overcome the resource limitations and environmental limitations that seem to face us right now.
Sounds like fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay, one thing I should have mentioned before playing that was that the theme of all the talks on the second day was solving the world's problems. So not being timid about taking on a big set of challenges. And I was really impressed by Ramez because he laid out these huge potential problems, climate change and peak oil and the possibility that we'll run out of fresh water, and you know, laid out four or five of these major, massive, cataclysmic things that could happen. And here's what, and all under the umbrella of talking about the Earth as kind of this living thing, this biome, not completely unfamiliar ideas. You'll hear a lot of people talking about these different problems, and you frequently hear the idea that the Earth is kind of a living organism. What really makes a talk at the Singularity Summit stand out is where he then goes with that, because what one typically expects to then hear is, well, so therefore we must relinquish technology, we need to back down from the progress that we've made, and kind of rein in humanity, rein in civilization, rein in technology, so that none of these bad things will happen. And of course, Ramez is pushing us in the direction saying, No, innovation and intelligence are the most powerful forces in the world. And if we're going to take on these challenges, we take them on by moving ahead. And I think that is a really refreshing treatment of those kinds of problems. And it's the kind of thing you hear at the Singularity Summit. It's not the kind of thing you hear typically when somebody brings up peak oil or climate change. So I want to put this out to the group. The accusation might be made that groups like the attendees at the Singularity Summit or, you know, Foresight Institute or any of a number of these organizations that that promote these kinds of ideas actually have too much faith in technology, too much faith in progress, and that if you list out all these problems and you really want to get serious, you're not just going to say, well, technology is going to take care of it. How would you respond to that? I'll start with Christine. I'm sure that you probably have some thoughts on that.
Well, I think there are definitely big issues and problems to be addressed, and I think it was more the downside of technology that stimulated the formation of Foresight rather than the benefit. After all, you know, the market will eventually deliver technological benefits. Why would you need a nonprofit organization to look at issues like nanotechnology? And the answer is, well, to look at potential downsides and try to head them off. So I would agree that that technology does raise issues and problems, and the answer isn't always just a simple more technology pathway. But I think there are policy options that we can have. One of the ones that I suggest is called open source sensing. You can see that at opensourcesensing.org. So I think these are legitimate issues to raise. We need to debate them and try to come up with policy recommendations.
Okay. George, PJ, thoughts on that?
I definitely agree with Christine. I think there needs to be a tempered approach here, and I think we really do as a community run the risk of coming into these conferences and being all cheery-eyed and all, you know, and glasses definitely, you know, brimming to the top in terms of our optimism. While I agree that we certainly, you know, for many of the problems that we're facing right now, we can apply our technologies and work to alleviate some of these problems. At the same time, I think we need to be careful and make sure that that maybe there are other solutions that can essentially, you know, solve the same sorts of, you know, problems. What I'd like to see when it comes to these sorts of events are more of the specialists in their fields come out. So bring climate change scientists in there. Bring, for example, experts on artificial life who are concerned, for example, about the negative potential there and the, you know, and the creation of novel organisms that might prove to be disastrous, that sort of thing. So the conversation has to be extended, and just so that we're more informed, because otherwise, you know, as a community, we'll be far too inclusive, and we're going to be kind of bouncing ideas in our own heads, and many of them probably more optimistic than they need to be. And, you know, they're also very guilty of selectional biases where we're really only looking for data and evidence that's going to support our suspicions and not look at necessarily the data that may run contradictory to that. So I think, that's how I'd like to see perhaps some of these conferences change in the future.
Well, and I want to say in fairness that certainly there is a good deal in the material that was presented at the conference, a good deal of serious attention paid to risks, to potential downsides, to potential bad outcomes, and even Ramez. I don't mean to suggest that he was being glib or giving a completely Pollyanna-ish view of technology. So when I lay out that question, I don't mean to be I'm playing devil's advocate here to a certain extent, and I don't want to put the event in a light other than is appropriate for
right.
it.
And I certainly didn't want to maybe indicate that the Ramez is perhaps that, you know, overly optimistic type. Again, I know Ramez personally as a dear friend, and his ideas are very closely mirror my own. So I know that he's definitely, if he was part of this conversation, he'd be in full on agreement with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, he's talking about the risks. He's talking about the downsides. Stephen, any thoughts on that?
I appreciate how he was not afraid to slaughter sacred cows, and even in just the short visits you had with him, Phil. You know, if you take a political divide, you know, divide up the country on the left and right. Those on the left might tend to lean towards relinquishment as the solution, and those on the right would say there's no problem at all when it comes to things like climate change. And it just seems to me that this balanced approach of looking at, we got a problem, but you know, the proper way to handle it is perhaps innovation. It seems to me a balanced approach that you might not be getting anywhere else, and so I do appreciate that. I wanted to mention also Matt Ridley in The Rational Optimist said something very close to what Rama has just said. He said in his book, the most unsustainable thing we can do is to abandon innovation.
Okay.
And I completely agree.
That will count as our weekly Rational Optimist mention, I think. We've had a reference to that book every week since I started reading it, and then you took over having started reading it. So we'll be coming back to The Rational Optimist, that terrific book for anyone who hasn't picked it up yet. Okay, PJ, take us home on this topic. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to sort of pull threads from all of your concepts, because you all make excellent points, and if I can add one more sort of on the top of it, here we have this community of technological optimists in general, if I can use a stereotype. However, what you forget is the world itself is not necessarily technologically optimistic. And we do have a world of politics. We do have a world of bureaucracy. Sometimes this is the necessary stopgap. Sometimes it's a dangerous obstacle. And it's very difficult for people who are enthusiastic about technological innovation to remember that we have these issues of implementation. And I wish that was discussed more within these kinds of conference contexts, because I know for a fact half a dozen people involved at the governmental level, be it with energy policy, with health policy, who are looking at these, you know, optimistic changes and saying, hold on a second, guys, nothing's going to happen here for years, even if the technology is available. So that's something we as a optimistic community have to be aware of, as well as have more input from these policy organizations who will ultimately make decisions on our behalf.
Ironically, solving the technological problems might be the easy part.
Often that's the case. You know, let's face it, you know, we know we have an oil problem, and yet we have so few solutions on the ground. The technology is available, but there's not a lot of will. Not a lot of public will, and even if the public will is there, there's not a lot of industrial will.
Right, right.
I believe Bruce Sterling is famous for saying that the future is here already, it's just not evenly distributed yet, and I think it's a very potent quote, and I find myself reflecting on it all the time, and one thing that bothers me oftentimes when I hear is that one of the justifications for genetically modified foods and crops, and again, I'm not going to make any position statement on GMOs, but one of the arguments in favor of it is that it's going to help us feed the world. It's going to help us deal with the starvation problems around the world. And when I hear that, I tend to lose it a little bit, because I know that we are producing more than enough food right now to feed all the people on this planet. It's an issue of distribution, and as PJ said, it's an issue of will and political will. Is how do we actually go about it such that we can actually distribute all this food to those who need it in a timely manner? So sometimes we can be distracted by what we think are going to be technological fixes. Oh, here's a problem, and here's a technological fix, when, in fact, there really isn't a problem from a technological perspective, but one more in terms of deployment or even just common sense.
Right. I think that the issue of distribution is ever with us, isn't it? It's interesting that we are in a world now where we've talked often about how over the past 20 years more people have been lifted out of poverty than in all of human history prior to this, and yet you still have a bottom quarter of the population of the planet that goes to bed hungry every night. And I think that was what Ramez was getting at when he was talking about it doesn't all go bad and it doesn't all go good, which tends to be the template that people read from when they talk about these kinds of things. So if you hear the typical talk about peak oil or fresh water or global warming, it is a very gloomy outlook on the world because there's an assumption of a trend that's going to lead in this disastrously bad direction. Now, the accusation that a group like the Singularity Summit or Foresight or any of these kinds of groups are just Pollyannas because they assume technology is going to fix the problem, I think one is unfair. I don't think that really characterizes how those people respond to those kinds of issues. But more importantly, I think it ignores the fact that the assumption on the other side is that technology and progress can't solve the problem. And that is an equally blinkered, if you ask me, position, right? I mean, it's to assume that it can't possibly solve the problem, I think, is just as tunnel visioned as to assume that it absolutely will.
You sometimes hear things like, what has the technology ever done for us? George, I tend to lose it when I hear that. So,
You know where I love reading that one is in a blog comment.
Yeah. You just typed that on a computer for the whole world to see. Yeah. So, anyway, yeah.
But speaking of those issues and speaking of the various various approaches, I just want to mention Jose Cordeiro, who spoke towards the end of the conference. And interesting background: this guy was a political exile from Venezuela, and he's now part of the UN Millennium Council, and he's a teaching fellow at Singularity University. So he was actually talking about climate and talking about energy, and just things he would throw out kind of on the side. He just said, in 30 years we'll have a space elevator. And I was like, wait, stop. How? Who? What's going to make that happen, you know? And it's interesting that comes from the United Nations. A guy in the United Nations project is saying that. I'm like, I'm very excited to hear that. I'd like to see that one backed up. But one of the tidbits that he dropped was Craig Venter's bacteria will eat CO2 and excrete 99-octane gasoline. We've talked a little bit about this, Stephen, in the past, this bioengineered bacteria that essentially creates a highly powerful fuel. And he describes the transition as this, from fossil hydrocarbons to living carbohydrates, a major phase shift. And he compares it to the phase shift that occurred when we went from whale oil to petroleum. He predicts something like that occurring. So, granted, there are huge policy considerations. There are social forces at work, economic forces at work, and yet somehow in the past we've made these leaps before. We went from whale oil to petroleum, and it's entirely possible that the tumblers will fall into place for us to leap from petroleum to much more efficient solar or to new biofuels. The thing that keeps me reasonably optimistic is just that there are so many different ways that things can work out. We're sitting on so many different possibilities that it's like spreading your bets on the roulette board, right? You only need one of them to pay off, and you've probably got yourself covered. Speaking of which, this kind of leads me to the next interview. This was with Brian Wong, and he and I were at lunch talking about Ramez's talk, and Brian had some additional thoughts on the same subject. So let's go ahead and – but before we play that, I should say I was having a little bit of trouble with my recorder, so the sound quality is a bit off. I had to clip a few things out, so if Brian sounds a little clipped, Brian, I apologize for that. We'll have you on next week, and you can talk at your normal pace.
I'm talking with Brian Wong of nextbigfuture.com. Brian, how's the Singularity Summit going for you so far? Are you having a good time, and what have been the high points for you up to now?
Yeah, so I've enjoyed the conference. Going from the most recent talk, yeah, I felt he had a, you know, decent enough talk about climate change, global warming, and you know, he talked about the scale of problems beginning, which I'm well aware of, and read many articles about. Even if it's not proven per se, not think that's necessarily an issue. And then he talked about solutions, which he talked, of course, on his focus on biological, enhanced biology, genetic engineering type solutions to the problem, which I agree with that, as well as, you know, nuclear energy and nanotechnology and many other technologies. But so one thing is that one of my general issues with all those kind of things is that you don't need to get into all of the aspects of, you know, how many degrees rise, what's going to happen, because I think we can grab more control of the situation, that we should be looking more at the immediate impact of air pollution, that we've had that for decades. This is referring to a talk by Elliot Yudkowsky, this is a bat that's been hitting us in the head every day for, you know, for 100 years. And just got used to it.
And when you say air pollution, you're not talking about just CO2, you're talking about other pollutants too, or?
Right. I'm talking about particulate, the microparticles of, you know, 5 to 10 microns in size, which, about 15 microns in size, which are ones that have been shown by Harvard Medical Studies to increase the cancer and heart disease, and basically probably cause about 30% of our disease and stuff. So it has a huge cost in terms of our medical costs, in terms of society, acid rain, you know, on the East Coast, you know, it'll cause more maintenance to happen on your buildings like that. And the World Health Organization said it could kill 3 million people per year worldwide. And in the U.S., it's probably 60,000. In Europe, it's probably about 250,000. So it's a massive amount of deaths, and people died on the average about 14 years earlier because of this air pollution stuff. So if you have 55 million people dying worldwide every year, you know, this is a big chunk, right? And then there's also the fact that there's water pollution and other things like the mercury from mainly from coal and diesel and that kind of thing. You know, everyone says, okay, don't eat, you know, big fish or whatever like that because of the mercury, or, you know, pregnant women shouldn't eat fish. This is because of this pollution that we're not containing.
So what would be the... you know, some quick hits on what would be good technological solutions in your view to this? Because it's interesting you bring that up. You don't hear much about that anymore. You don't hear much about air pollution, water pollution. You hear about climate change, right? You don't hear about fixing the environment anymore. So what would be the quick fixes, or what would be the ideas for fixes that we're not hearing about?
Yeah. So the quickest fixes, well, they are still in the process. Is one, if you put more remediation on the plant. On the coal plant, on the diesel plant, you know, one, you know, China's trying to shut down like 2,087 factories that are big polluters, trying to shut them down. Generally, the smaller, older plants are the worst ones. There's something called Source Watch, which lists out each plant and how much pollution it's putting out. And the Clean Air Act that were put in place in the 70s and 80s for the U.S., which, you know, prevented things, it made it better, say 50% better, 80% better. Still meant people were dying, but it was less visible. You didn't drive around, you know, L.A. you still see the smog, but, you know, you see it less in other cities, but it's still there. It's just that it's gone below the threshold where it's like you don't have 1962 London fog, people dropping dead in the street, you know, for 2 weeks, you know, 14,000 people dying. So some quick hits, yeah, so you clean up the plants, you shut down the dirtiest ones, you don't grandfather and let the old ones pollute, you say, okay, we stop them. So there is plenty of technology which you can use to apply that would reduce the problem by another 80%.
What about, is part of the issue that as much work that could be done in the developed world, standards are more lax in the developing world, and that, you know, we're all breathing the same air, or is that a big part of the issue?
It's both. You know, the U.S. still has plenty of pollution on this front, but yeah, standards were more lax in China and in other countries that were less developed. Although China's fixing that now, they're converting to newer plants because China can build plants very fast. So they, and not only is the bigger plant cleaner, it's also more efficient. You know, instead of, you know, it can be, you know, 20% more efficient because it just scales better. It's burning through the thing more thoroughly, and so, you know, they can just build their way out of it. You know, shut down the old ones and build the new ones. ones and everything. But then there's also building more nuclear power, because nuclear power has displaced since the 1970s, really, when you first had a lot of nuclear power. You had about 65,000 terawatt hours of nuclear power. So that basically displaced, you know, prevented the deaths of 3 million people if that had been coal power instead. And the current 2,600 terawatt hours per year of nuclear power worldwide is about 50% of the amount of coal power. So if you didn't have it, you would have had 50% more coal. So, but you can increase that by 50% if you went aggressively at power upgrades. So the things that have really boosted nuclear power, even though they haven't been building a lot of plants, is the fact that operations have improved. So you went from 50% operating efficiency up to 90% operating efficiency in the best country, U.S., South Korea, some other place. And then, so operating efficiency went up, but you can't really push much beyond 90%, 95%, but you should get it, for places that are still 70%, like Ukraine and other more efficient countries. They're working on it. But then you can uprate. So I take the existing plant, I put in better turbines, I put in annular fuel. So instead of a cylinder of fuel, a rod of fuel, I put in a cylinder with some small piece inside, increase the surface area. So then that allowed me to cool more efficiently. It's also called dual cool fuel. And South Korea is working to implement this MIT technology into their current plant. And that would allow about a 20% increase in energy without all I do is change my fuel load. You know, 2-3 years time when you have to do a new load of fuel, I put in the new fuel, done, 20% more power.
So we make the old plants more efficient, we build new plants, we close down the ones that are polluting, and we can start making some progress on that front. Brian, we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, once again, I have to apologize for the sound quality there. He and I were sitting outside. The earlier interview, I was in the press room, and it makes a big difference whether you've got ambient noise in the background or not. But I hope you were able to hear what Brian was talking about there. And this to me, is kind of the other side of the coin. And I love Brian's perspective on things. It's always so great sitting down and talking with him, because he always takes me someplace I don't expect to go. We start talking about climate change and all these big existential threats, and he says, yeah, well, what about air pollution? Why don't we do something about air pollution? Well, here's a problem that we've been hearing about since my childhood, and probably before then, and that we don't actually hear about as much anymore. It doesn't have the political cachet that it once did, and he starts laying out some very practical, very reasonable, primarily technology-driven solutions that can be put in place. And Christine, you know what this reminds me of? It seems to me that, just to use an analogy, Brian is kind of giving us some of the personalized energy and environment things that we could do, similar to personalized life extension. These are smaller incremental steps that could be taken before we get to the big life-altering, life-changing one. So I guess my question is, how do we achieve the right balance between the practical problem-solving that, practical application of technology to problems that we face in the immediate future or in the present or that have lingered from the past, and some of these more far-reaching kind of long-term solutions?
Wow, that's a tough question. That's a really big question. I think you can look at it at different levels. You can look at it at the personal level, saying how much do I personally, in terms of my own effort, want to put into the near term versus the long term. And then we could ask it again at the societal level, in terms of societal investment, what proportion of our resources should go into longer term efforts. And I think the first one, the personal question, is going to vary a lot for each person. I think the vast majority of people have no interest in the longer term. Their time horizon just is not long enough to participate in those discussions or to make those investments. For those of us, anyone listening, I think, to this radio station, has the ability to think these longer term on these longer term time horizons, but it's again a very personal decision how much time you're willing to put into longer term efforts. So it's not something I can answer. It's something we each have to look at. In terms of the society, I think we can. That's something that we have to debate. Currently, our society votes to put a certain fraction of our national resources here in the U.S. into science R&D. And that number goes up and down depending on the enthusiasm of the public for science and for the future and also our military situation. So, and that's a political process. And if we want larger fractions of our resources to go to longer-term things, we have to either get together and form a group to promote that, and we can promote it through governments, either through government spending or maybe perhaps tax credits for R&D, or we can go to the private sector and form foundations to do scientific research or try to do it through for-profit companies. So there's a lot of ways to come at that question. Of course, I have a bias personally toward the longer term, so I would love to see more resources go to that, but that's just one person.
I think it's really interesting. You mentioned R&D funding, and this is something that, that Ramez touched on in his talk. He mentioned how U.S. Energy R&D spending is at $1.8 billion a year, whereas defense R&D is at $78 billion a year, some of which does trickle down to energy, but the difference between the two is I mean, it says quite a bit right there. That you know that where we're putting our R&D money right now. When you consider the strategic value, the critical strategic nature of energy for the world we live in, you would think that that there might be a little bit more balance between them. And he mentioned that as he closed that meanwhile we spend about $1 trillion a year on energy as a country. So yeah, you would think that. You would think that these kinds of issues would be something that we would if we're going to be putting money into R&D at all, this would be the kind of stuff we'd be taking a closer look at. PJ, I want to turn this over to you because you mentioned the problem of political will, the problem of getting organized enough to make these kinds of things happen, and I think one of the objections that some would make to the whole view of this as political problems is that right now it doesn't seem that our governmental infrastructure is even suited to address the short-term problems, right? They're not even doing the kinds of things Brian is talking about to solve air pollution, much less take on the big ones. How would you respond to that kind of argument?
Well, I guess I'd break it up into two categories. I'd break it up into the notion of real politic. What's the reality for a political leader to get something accomplished? What does it take? What deals have to be made to get anything accomplished in this country, or any country for that matter? And then you have the issue of complexity, which takes it out of the political arena and puts it in an entirely different, ratchets the problems up exponentially. And that is, we have a very, just in this country alone, a very complex series of systems, not even one complex system, many systems. When we make one major change in anything, be it the form of, let's say, even just gasoline in a petroleum plant, this changes so many aspects of industry, people's lives, etc. People don't like change. So while on one hand, the nation says, we need to get off oil. On the other hand, people are saying, but wait, what about my job? People think inherently short-term, as Christine pointed out. There are very, very few long-term thinkers in general in society. If you're thinking short-term, you're thinking about where's my next paycheck? Do I have a job? Can I feed my family? Will I have a roof over my head? These are the questions that people are concerned about right now. So it's really hard for them to get their head around, well, maybe if we change our energy policy, that's something I need to get behind because that will benefit me. They don't see the benefit. And in fact, they won't see the benefit for years to come because the processes take so long. So while I am a technological optimist, I am a societal pessimist.
Hmm. That's an interesting combo. And I can see where you would arrive at that position. It does seem that our innate ability to do things. I think, George, you were talking about this. That is, our technical ability to do things outstrips our will to actually make certain things happen. Although I think we eventually catch up. Well, as we run near to our time, George, I guess you get the last word on the subject. How do we strike that balance between the near term and the long term?
And again, a lot of great answers already. I just want to touch on a couple of things. One thing I would really like to see, and again, I totally agree about the dichotomy between short-term thinking and long-term thinking and how difficult it is to bridge that gap. I mean, E.O. Wilson, he said that we have paleolithic brains, which prevent us from looking really beyond our generation and our children's generation, and we can't really think beyond that. So, and as PJ mentioned, you know, we have this kind of hierarchy of needs that we're all very much married to and make sure that we have our basic needs met. So it's difficult to invest ourselves too much in some dramatic changes. But I think in the short term, what I would like to see is perhaps a greater politicization of environmental issues. And what I mean by that is some more powerful government bodies and just more government energy in that direction to both find out what the problem is. Like what Brian was saying, like we don't even necessarily even know what the problem is. Like, or we've forgotten. Like I remember as well when I was a kid, the big bugaboo was acid rain, and we don't talk about acid rain anymore, but I'm sure it still exists. You know, I mean, it didn't go away because I'm sure we didn't necessarily. I mean, we're still using polluting with carbon as much as we ever have been. So, what I also mean in terms of kind of giving political impetus behind this is to see as well things like green parties emerge and start to become a bit more agitating in that sense. I'm not necessarily suggesting that we need to see green parties actually elected to hold the seats of power. Here in Canada, where we have a parliamentary democracy, we have a green party that has emerged over the last several years. It's still very much in an infantile sort of a state, but you can see that as alienation grows each and every year with the system and with the two major parties who tend to swap the ruling obligations, that in a way the protest vote seems to be gravitating more toward the Green Party. And maybe not even fair of me to say that. Maybe there is more of an environmental consciousness that's emerging, and people do want, in fact, to see a party that's, again, like I said, not necessarily in power, but certainly one that's, you know, in Parliament there that's agitating and can say, look, this is what's important. And we need these bodies, whether they be, whether we have them that are public or private, but they need to let us know what the problems are so that we can actually get down to the nitty-gritty. And I love what Christine had to say about things like research and development funding and basically trying to instigate that in the private sector. I know here in Canada we have an excellent program right now where companies can claim back 60 cents on the dollar for pure research and development work. And mind you, we do that here because we are afraid of falling down the technology gap. Obviously, we have the United States to the south of us, and there are other countries that are doing very well technologically. We are very afraid through brain drain and other issues that we're going to fall behind. But imagine if you had a similar sort of program where you would fund to that degree research and development, but targeted research and development. So R&D that's going to create cleaner fuels, or will pull carbon out of the sky, or whatever it might be, whatever the again what has been identified as the problem for that given time. So that's my thinking for some of these issues anyway. And just even as well, it can also be kind of punitive. I would like to see as well, if you're not going to be doing anything in the R&D world or anything that's kind of constructive that way, well, then we're gonna penalize you, or we're gonna tax the hell out of you. So, I'm a big supporter of the carbon tax as one of the ways in which we can start to combat climate change right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I you had me till the carbon tax. We're not going to get into specific political issues, but I really like the idea of the of new political entities emerging, especially if we can see them with some to go back to my earlier phrase, some somewhat modified templates. If we can see these folks thinking in ways that we haven't necessarily seen them thinking before. I especially like the idea of pushing towards additional research and development and developing new technological solutions. You know, the kind of going back to Ramez's approach to all this is that you is that you push for a green agenda, but you do it by way of befriending technology and innovation, not by viewing those as the enemy. Well, we're very close on our time here, so I have to just quickly thank each of our panel members. I wish we had made it a 2-hour show, Stephen. Once again, we find we have a lot more to say than we have time to say it. I'm just going to quickly once again say Personalized Life Extension Conference, October 9th and 10th, 2010 at the San Francisco Airport Marriott. Go to lifeextensionconference.com, or you can look for links there on The Speculist. Stephen, what do we got going on with music this evening?
The song is Parted Blinds by John Crumley.
Can you say that title again of the song?
Parted Blinds.
Parted Blinds, okay, by
John Crumley.
John Crumley singing Parted Blinds. All right, well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and for all your contributions. Thanks for our chatters, for a great chat this evening, everyone listening live and for everyone listening recorded. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back at the regular time again next week with special guest Brian Wong, and until then, live to see it.
For you to step on the lawn. If your frisbee lands there, it is gone. You think I mean the notion that I regret, 'cause I'm the worst one that you ever met. Here watching the party.